Sportscaster Howard Cosell drank, quote, before, during, and after telecasts, unquote. And once he threw up on Don Meredith's cowboy boots during a Monday Night Football game broadcast after drinking too much vodka. I'll bet you can see the expression on Dandy Don's face. According to Jim Spence, the author of the book Up Close and Personal, The Inside Story of Network Television Sports, he said Howard Cosell was a very unhappy individual. Spence, who worked for ABC for 26 years as a senior vice president in network sports, made this comment about Cosell. He had made millions of dollars, traveled the world, been applauded and honored time and time again, yet today, I think he is one of the unhappiest human beings on this planet. Author Ernest Hemingway has led a life that few Americans would ever dream of living. He was an ambulance driver in World War I and a war correspondent in World War II, traveled around the world hunting big game, fishing off the coast of Cuba. In 1953, he won a Pulitzer Prize, and he won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1954. He's considered by many to be one of the greatest American novelists that ever lived. And yet, in despair and despondency, in 1961, in a hunting lodge in Idaho, he took out a gun and blew his brains out. What do these two men have in common? Unparalleled success. These are two of the greatest success stories of the 20th century. To that list, we could add some names like Howard Hughes, like J. Paul Getty. These men are men of success. And yet they also have something else in common. You know what that is? They were extremely miserable individuals. You know, there's a rumor going around Austin. If you listen closely, you'll hear it. In fact, the rumor is not just confined to Austin. It's all of Central Texas is kind of talking about it too. And, you know, if you get outside of Central Texas, the rest of the United States, and yes, even the world, is spreading around this rumor. And, you know, actually, it's not even being whispered anymore. It's being shouted from the rooftops. And the rumor is this, that success will bring satisfaction. That there is satisfaction in being successful. Is that true? Is that true? When you've accomplished all your goals and fulfilled all of your dreams, will you be happy? Will you have satisfaction? We're going to look at a man this morning, or the writings of a man this morning, who had unparalleled success. The man's name is Solomon. Solomon was the greatest king of the nation of Israel. He built an empire that was unparalleled in that nation's history. His building projects were unparalleled. His palace, the temple that he built, the export business that he built by building a navy himself, the armies that he amassed and acquired, the land that he controlled. This guy was so well-to-do that he could support over 300 wives and 700 concubines. Now think of what you would have to have, men, in income to support 1,000 women. This man had it all. And yet he wrote one of the most sad, probably the saddest book in the Bible, the book of Ecclesiastes, where he tells about all of his achievements and all of his misery. Turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 4, and we're going to look at a few verses this morning. And I want you to keep in mind, we're looking at the verses that were penned by a man who is not writing from a position of sour grapes. Well, I failed to achieve, and therefore I'm going to tell you how bad it is to be at the top. We're talking about a guy who actually had been there and writes from the top to tell us today about some destructive drives that can make and break you. They can make and break you. The three destructive drives that we're going to look at this morning in the passage of Ecclesiastes would probably find themselves right up at the very top of the principles for being a successful person in this world. Success in business, achievement in popularity and in the world. If you have these drives, you will probably make it. You'll probably become a success. But will you be satisfied? Look at verse 4 of Ecclesiastes chapter 4. Solomon writes, I have seen, now this is from his observations, from his experience. Here's a man who's been there, he's been on top, he's looked around, he's hobnobbed with the rich and famous, and this is his experience that he's relating to us. This is not some pie in the sky, pious preacher talking from a lack of knowledge. This is a guy that's been there. He says, I have seen that every labor and every skill which is done is the result of rivalry between a man and his neighbor. This too is vanity and striving after the wind. The first destructive drive that we see in this passage is envy. That is the drive to outdo the other guy. He says it very strong. He says, I have seen that every labor and every skill, labor is hard work, skill is achievement or accomplishment. Every accomplishment of mankind, every task that mankind undertakes, every one of them, which is done, is the result of what? A destructive drive, rivalry between a man and his neighbor. Have you experienced this? They move a guy in the office right next to you who's doing the same thing that you do, only he does it a little better. And all of a sudden you find your performance going up. The number of hours that you're willing to work grows greater. The guy next door to you pulls in his driveway with a brand new boat. And boy, you go over and look at it, and you start looking it over, and you start thinking to yourself, man, I'd like to have one of these too. If he can earn it on his income, why can't I have it on mine? A student gets moved from the average class into the overachievers, the gifted and talented, and all of a sudden, studying becomes a priority. When they were sitting next to the dunce in school, studying was not that important, but now they're sitting next to the brain, and all of a sudden, the desire to compete with, to outdo, to rival, produces all kinds of hard work. The question is, does it have any value? Does it satisfy? Solomon says no. Latter part of verse 4, he says, this too is vanity and striving after wind. The word vanity is a word that Solomon uses over and over and over again in this book. And the word itself means meaninglessness. It doesn't mean lack of activity. It means meaninglessness. And then he defines the word striving after the wind. If you were to chase the wind, it would take a lot of energy, wouldn't it? It would take a lot of time, wouldn't it? You'd be involved in activity, but the end result is zero. It's like the dog that chases cars. What good is that? That's ridiculous. That's meaningless. And that dog gets out there in the hot sun, and every car that comes by, the dog's out there chasing it and chasing it and chasing it. Never catches one, but what if he did? What would he do with it? Good question. What would he do with it? Man, think about it. Think about the size of the hole that he would have to dig to put that car in it. That'd be big, wouldn't it? Can't eat a car.
No.
Not at all. Chew on the tires, I guess. It's kind of like the starving man who sits down to a big buffet dinner of cotton candy. It's like the woman who's dying of thirst that finds a jug in the desert that's got 2 drops of water in it. It doesn't satisfy. It's like the small child standing at the graveside of his parents and having a relative come up and pat him on the head and say, "It'll be okay." There's no comfort there. Oh, yeah, there's something, but it doesn't satisfy. And trying to live your life to outdo the other guy, to achieve, to be on top, to beat him out, that's meaningless. It will not bring satisfaction. Why? Because envy is a desire that can never be satisfied. You cannot outdo everyone. Sooner or later, you're going to find somebody that you cannot beat out. Sooner or later, you're going to come to the end of your abilities. You're going to find the end of your talents. You're going to find the end. And then, you're sunk. I'll never forget walking into seminary and sitting down in a classroom full of guys that looked like me and acted like me, and I thought I was something coming out pretty close to the top of my graduating class from Bible college, but this guy next to me was an attorney. And there was a guy over here that was an engineer, and there was a guy over here that was a doctor. And though I could go through college and ace just about everything, I found out that I couldn't compete with these guys. It was tough. I'd kind of come to the end. And you'll find out the same thing too. And when that happens, that desire, that envy, will never, ever be satisfied. But Solomon says there's a better way, and that's the way of contentment. The way of contentment. Now, contentment may not make very good business sense, but it makes good sense for living. And there are 3 keys to contentment given in the verse. The first key is seen in verse 5. The fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. And this is a negative key. The first key is don't drop out. Don't drop out. You know, you may say, well, if most of my energy is to try to show myself one up on the other person, well, maybe I just shouldn't do anything. I'll just drop out of life. And Solomon says, don't do that. That's a foolish thing to do. The fool is the guy who says, well, I'm just not going to participate. And folding the hands is kind of like giving up. And what happens to the person who folds his hands, according to verse 5? He consumes his own flesh. Literally, he runs out of resources until he has to start living on the very things that sustain him, his own body. And the end result of that is death. So don't drop out. The second key to contentment is to enjoy your rest. Verse 6 says, one hand full of rest is better than 2 fists full of labor and striving after the wind. One hand full of rest is better than 2 fistfuls with labor. Enjoy your rest, tranquility. Better to have one hand full and be able to enjoy life and have it all and hate life. You know, life is a gift from God. And I think if God had anything to say to the average American today, he'd say, lighten up. Lighten up. Enjoy life. I gave it to you not as a conquest, not to beat everybody to the top, not to have everything that everybody else has, but to enjoy life. And if you can make a living and have time to enjoy your family, your friends, be involved in ministry, what more do you want? What good does it get you to beat everybody out. Enjoy your rest. It's a gift from God. God's given us life to enjoy, not to conquer and beat somebody else. The third key to contentment is learn the meaning of enough. Learn the meaning of enough. One handful of rest is better than two fistfuls with labor. When is enough enough? Enough's enough when you get one handful. That's all you need. And then you can enjoy your rest. Y'all have seen the kid come running in when mom was pouring out the M&Ms and she's going to give each kid some M&Ms and, oh, fill up both hands, mom. Fill it up to the very top. And the child's standing there with a hand full, two hands full of M&Ms. And now what's he going to do with it? He's going to spend the rest of the time trying to keep from spilling them. Because if he spills a couple, what does he do? Pick it up with his foot? I mean, he can't do anymore. The other kids are going to come and get them from him because he can't protect himself anymore. How's he going to eat them? Until his hands are green and yellow and brown and red from the saliva and the stains of melted candy. And so many of us have the same experience in life. We've grabbed onto this world with two fists. And we're hanging on so tight to the stuff that we got that we can't enjoy life. We can't relax. We can't let go. Because if we let our guard down for a minute, if we relax for a moment, the other guy's going to get the promotion. He's going to beat me out. I can't let up. Learn the meaning of enough. It'll free you up to enjoy life. Envy is the drive to outdo others, and it can make you successful, but it will not ever satisfy you. But contentment will. The second destructive drive that can make and break you as well, seen in verse 7. Solomon writes, "Then I looked again at vanity under the sun, and there was a certain man without a dependent, having neither a son nor a brother. Yet there was no end to all his labor. Indeed, his eyes were not satisfied with riches, and he never asked, 'And for whom am I laboring and depriving myself of pleasure?' This too is vanity, and it is a grievous task." Man number two doesn't have any relatives, no brothers, no sons, no dependents. Appears that he has no friends either from the tone of the passage. But yet he's working and working and working and working and working. What's this destructive drive? It's the drive of craving more. The drive to have it all. The drive to have it all. What a crazy guy. Trying to have it all. The man's got no one to leave it to. He's got no one that appreciates it. And yet, he's laboring with an insatiable drive. Notice the way Solomon phrases his drive. He says in the middle of the passage, "Indeed, his eyes were not satisfied with riches." This literally, in the literal Hebrew, is that his eyes were only half full. Think of the picture. He brings it out in front of him, all the things that he's acquiring, like the king who sits on his royal throne and has all of his possessions marched before him. And you know what? He can cram as much stuff as he can in front of him, and his eyes are still only half full. That's all that he can get in there. Bring in another boat. Bring in another house. Bring in another company. Half full. Come on, you can get more in here, can't you? I can acquire more. I can work more hours. I can do more things. I can get more degrees. I can write more books. I can make more inventions. Half full. His eyes are only half full. And this guy is laboring and grieving and struggling and toiling, trying to achieve. And guess what? Half full eyes. Are your eyes half full? Do you look around at all the things that you have today that you craved last year, and you were finally able to get this year, and you know what? They're not that important. They don't fill up that space. Your eyes are only half full. You know what happens? The craving for more and more inspires all kinds of energy to work harder and longer. And you know what suffers? Relationships. Relationships. You see, there is a better way. And that better way is the way of relationships. Solomon goes on in verse 9 to say, two are better than one. We got this old geezer over here that's working his whole life by himself to have more and more and more. What does Solomon say? Two are better than one. Why? Because they have a good return for their labor. For if either of them falls, the one will lift up his companion. But woe to the one who falls when there is not another to lift him up. Furthermore, if two lie down together, they keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? And if one can overpower him who is alone, two can resist him. A cord of three strands is not quickly torn apart. There are a lot of advantages of two over one. This guy's painted himself in a corner. He doesn't have time for people. He's working for things. But the benefits of people, of relationships, are seen in this passage. In verse 10, we see that relationships provide support. If one falls down, there's somebody else there to pick him up. And if you have somebody close to you, a strong relationship that you've invested in, that person is there to support you. The second benefit of relationships is seen in verse 11. The benefit of comfort. If two lie down together, they keep warm. They have comfort. They have companionship. They can take care of each other. But to the one who lays down by himself, there's no warmth there. And finally, the third benefit seen in verse 12, the benefit of security. If one can be overpowered by another, think how much safety there is with two. At the point in time where somebody comes against you to attack you, there's security in relationships. Now, the rich man can buy all these things, can't he? The rich man can buy all that. He can buy somebody to be a business partner, to be there, to help him out when he gets in trouble. He can buy all the blankets in the world to keep him warm at night and a real nice cozy house to sleep in. He can buy bodyguards that'll be around him all the time. But it's not the same thing, is it? It's not the same thing. It's not the same thing when people are there because they have to be rather than people being there because they want to be. That's true relationships. And I wonder how often do our relationships get pushed to the back in order to satisfy this destructive drive that makes us very successful but very unsatisfied. Judith Vos wrote a poem called Alone, and she talks about the benefits of being alone. Alone, I could own both sides of the double bed and stay up reading novels half the night, and no one would be there telling me to turn off the light and hogging the blankets. And no one would be there saying he's taking the car and noticing that I let the milk turn sour. Alone, I could talk long distance for an hour, and who would stop me? And no one would be there brushing his teeth with my brush and pushing the thermostat down to 60 degrees. Alone, I could give Goodwill my boots and my skis and switch to the beaches. Alone, I could give up understanding Brie, Detente, the Super Bowl, and Cousin Rose. And no one would be there telling me which of my clothes make me look chunky. And no one would be there steaming the bathroom up and wanting his back massaged and his buttons sewn. And no one would be there, and I would be alone, and I would hate it. And how many of us are on that fast track to being alone? Oh, your wife's not going to leave you today or tomorrow. Your spouse is not fixing to walk out on you. But when the kids are grown and gone, and you wake up and look at each other in the mirror, when you reach the ripe old age of retirement, and it's time to spend time together, and you find out there's no relationship there, there's no love there. You've coexisted together, but you had your schedule, and she had her schedule, and they didn't meet very often. When the kids grow up and you find it's hard to get them to come home at Christmas, it's hard to get them to come home at Thanksgiving. It's hard to get them to take a vacation at your house because you don't have a relationship with them. They were there, but you didn't invest any time in them because your time was given to the pursuit of acquiring more. At that point in time, we will all look back and grieve over our loss, like Solomon did. But there is a better way. That's the way of relationships. And finally, Solomon talks about the third destructive drive that can make you successful, but also break you. Verse 13, he says, a poor yet wise lad is better than an old and foolish king who no longer knows how to receive instruction. For he, that is the young lad, has come out of prison to become king, even though he was born poor in his kingdom. And I have seen all the living under the sun throng to the side of the second lad who replaces him. There is no end to all the people, to all who were before them, and even the ones who will come later will not be happy with him. For this too is vanity and a striving after the wind. What's this drive here? This destructive drive that can make you successful, but also break you? It's the drive for popularity. The drive for popularity. The drive to be on top. See what's happening in this passage? You got this young whippersnapper, this wise, and Solomon says he's in a better position, he's better off than the old king who's foolish and will no longer receive instruction. How can that be, Solomon? I mean, the king's on top of the world. He's got it all. Well, because in the course of life, this young guy develops popularity, and pretty soon the people throng around him, and pretty soon he becomes king. And then he's on the throne until the people get tired of him, and then somebody else comes along. And Solomon says, in all of the people that come before and all of the people that come after, those few glorious moments when you're sitting on the top thinking, look at what I've achieved, success, it will not satisfy you. What do we remember most about Richard Nixon? Watergate? Did you know that Nixon graduated from Duke Law School? That he served as U.S. Representative for 2 terms? That he served as U.S. Senator for 2 terms? That he served as Vice President of these United States for 2 terms? Do you know that he established the Nixon Doctrine? How many of you even know what the Nixon Doctrine is? Do you know that he ended the U.S. involvement in Vietnam after almost a decade? Do you know that he opened up communication with Communist China and he was the first U.S. president to visit Moscow, laying the groundwork for the arms talks that have, in some ways, begun to stabilize our world? None of those things, individually, are anything to sneeze at. Becoming a U.S. representative, I mean, how successful can you get? Becoming a vice president, becoming a president, setting policy, changing the course of the world. And what do we remember about the bum? You see? What do we remember about Jimmy Carter? Hostages and the misery index. Those of you who bought something during the latter days of Jimmy Carter and paid 17 and 18% interest, you remember him. What do we remember about Ronald Reagan? What's come out in the press recently? What's the media doing to him? Most of it's bad, isn't it? Isn't most of it bad? You see, fame, success, popularity is very short-lived. How many remember who the prom queen was at Westwood 10 years ago? And yet there was a bunch of girls shedding tears last night over the fact that they did not make the court, or that they were not the queen. And you know, most of those girls won't care whatsoever who's the prom queen in 5 years. What difference does it make? You see, popularity is fickle. It's fickle. How many of you can tell me the 5 people that topped the Fortune 500 list as the most successful businessmen in 1965, 1970, 1975, 1980, 1985? A few of you may remember who made it last year, but I'll bet you it's less than half. I'll bet you it's less than a third. I'll bet you it's less than 5%. If you desire to be on top, and that's what's driving you, maybe not the President of the United States, but the head of your department, maybe on top in your field, you may be successful, but you won't find satisfaction there. And there is a better way. That way is the way of wisdom. And there are 3 stepping stones to acquiring wisdom. The first one we see in verse 13. Value where you are. Value where you are. That's the first one. Solomon says, a poor yet wise lad is better. Right here and now, today, he's better than an old and foolish king who will no longer knows how to receive instruction. Today, at this point in time, where that young guy that is wise, he's better off than the guy at the top. Better off. Value where you are. If you don't, you'll lose it. You'll miss it. If the next 24 hours are simply given to you in order to accomplish what you're going to do, the 24 hours after that, you've missed 24 hours. And it's better to be young and wise than old and foolish. Value where you are. The second stepping stone to wisdom is develop wisdom, a skill for living. Develop wisdom, a skill for living. Not success, wisdom. And the third stepping stone on the way to wisdom is to hold applause lightly. Hold applause lightly. You know, everybody at some point in their life gets a pat on the back. Everybody at some point in their life gets recognized for something that they do. And you know when that happens, there's a real dangerous possibility. And that is that you could get addicted to applause. That you could get addicted to achievement. That you could get addicted to recognition. And that will devastate your life. All of you remember who've worked before, the first time your employer came in and patted you on the back and said, "Man, you're doing a great job here. You deserve to be recognized." You all remember that day. And that started a little bit of that desire to get that on a regular basis. And that inspires all kinds of hard work leading to success. But maybe not satisfaction. Hold applause lightly. Keep in mind that there was a person that was there before you, and a person that was there before them, and a person that was there before them, and nobody even remembers their name. And there will be a person that comes after you, and there will be a person that comes after them, and they will not remember your name. And if you desire popularity, you won't be satisfied. But if you learn to live as a wise person, you'll find satisfaction. The life principle that we see in this passage is that destructive drives may inspire hard work leading to success, but not satisfaction. These drives of envy, of craving more, of popularity, they may lead to hard work, which brings you a tremendous amount of success, but not satisfaction. And there's nothing wrong with being successful. But there is something wrong with allowing these destructive drives to dominate you. Much better the way of contentment. Much better the way of relationships. Much better the way of wisdom. You may not be as successful, but you will be satisfied. One commentator sums up this passage in words that I think really captures the essence of what Solomon is saying. He says, finally, we contemplated in chapter 4 not the losers in this human struggle, but the apparent winners and survivors, those who managed to be utterly absorbed in it or in themselves. To all appearances, they have come to terms with life. But have they won a prize that they can keep? And does their way of winning it bear inspection? In our modern term, the rat race sums up the burden of these verses. A frantic rivalry at one extreme, a disastrous opting out at the other, and for the successful few, a life devoted to acquiring prize after pointless prize. Is your life devoted to that? Acquiring prize after pointless prize? Success without satisfaction? Tony Evans relates a poem that I've read to you before, but it puts things in perspective. One person puts it this way: I counted dollars while God counted crosses. I counted gains while He counted losses. I counted my worth by the things I gained in store. He sized me up by the scars that I bore. I coveted honors and sought degrees. He wept as He counted the hours I spent on my knees. I never knew until one day by the grave how vain are the things that we spend life to save. I did not yet know until my loved one went above that richest is he who is rich in God's love. Let's pray. Father, we are tired of struggling with this life, tired of being driven by destructive drives that have been encouraged by the society around us. We turn those over to You this morning. The need to outdo others, the need to have more, the need to be on top. Father, we give those up to You this morning. Our desire is to be content, to be in touch with our people, those who are close to us, to walk in wisdom, to be satisfied. And we know that that satisfaction only comes from You. Thank You for giving us the power to turn these over to You this morning and experience the full life and the joy that comes in knowing You. I pray for the person here this morning that is struggling deeply with these issues. I pray that they would not leave here today carrying these burdens with them, but they would leave it here and find their strength and comfort in You. We pray this in Jesus' precious name. Amen.